afternoon, and welcome to a fun-filled two-hour program. You're joining We the People Radio. I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Ooh, are you ever?
Oh, am I? Mic check. I get first seat today.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, well, that's the end of that. There goes my volume.
Yeah, turn your volume down.
Okay, well, I'm still
Bob Cundiff.
I'm Bob Martin.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
We had the girly man Bill there for a second.
Yeah.
It's a little too...
So how's it all going with the new... with our summer here and everything? I mean, it just went winter to summer.
Last week it was nice and lovely and...
Snow in the mountains.
Yeah. And today I saw a chihuahua being carried on a walk. You know it's hot.
You know it's hot.
When you got to carry your chihuahua. I'm like, don't they come from Mexico? Aren't
chihuahua
they supposed
down.
To be good at
the heat? Yeah, they're supposed to be good to heat.
Yeah, well,
no.
They're not.
Yeah, they're not.
If you're getting them to live in Reading, you're blowing it.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Hey, so...
What are we talking? Hey, we got a good show today, don't we?
Yeah, we have two different things. I don't know. Some people like it when we have two different things and some don't. So for those of you who do like it when we change it up in both hours, you are going to love it today. It's going to be fantastic for you. So the first hour, we have Lawrence Schaumburn on, and let's just talk about the great title of this program.
Okay, talk about it.
Has fake news spread to the judiciary?
Huh.
Because I think that's like a giant yes. Yeah. I'm just going to spoiler alert that. I think it's a yes. And then second hour, we have Peter Cove on. Peter Cove has written a book called Poor No More, Rethinking Dependency and the War on Poverty.
Be careful the way you say that.
What?
Poor No More.
I know. That is kind of a trick title there.
Yeah.
Poor No More.
There
three
you go.
Words.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting. And so we're going to talk about two different things that I think people care a lot about right now. And if they don't, they should.
Yeah.
So we're not going to talk about any of the dopey stuff.
Well, the whole fake news thing is
burying us
over the top right now. Everybody's talking about that.
Yeah, I guess we should say the word Russia just so we could be, popular.
Well, there was a Russian in here right when I walked in. I had to kick him out.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's trying to take over the radio show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't say anything to him, though.
Was he the guy who left the giant sack of pot in the grocery store parking lot?
That could have been a Russian conspiracy. It was true. That was not fake news.
I will check out
the Facebook page.
Seriously,
there.
I will post this online because yesterday we went to the grocery store, just minding our own beeswax, and we looked over and it looked like, it's rodeo week, okay? So it looked like maybe somebody parked out way out in the parking lot and like shoveled out their horse trailer.
Well, it looked like an elephant had maybe done something.
It looked
bad
a lot
there.
Like that
big
too.
Pile.
And so, but there was a security guard standing near it, and we thought, well, what the heck is that?
Didn't want anybody to step in the poop.
So anyway, we went over, and of course we were curious, and this is like 7 o'clock at night. And the closer we got, the more we realized it was a giant pile of pot.
Yeah.
In the parking lot.
Somebody spent a lot. It was good-looking pot, too. That's what they tell me. I wouldn't have any way of really knowing it for a fact, but giant buds. I mean, it was a pile.
It was kind of funny.
It was a big pile.
Only in California.
Yeah.
So, yes, I will post that, and it is blowing up on Facebook. I tell you what, if you really want to get people involved in a Facebook post, post a giant pile of pot with a security guard standing next to it. I had no idea that would be that popular. Let's see... 2,841 shares since last night about 7:30.
Yeah.
Now I put
smoke weed every day.
Nice, Bob.
Yeah.
So I put something on here that you put all these things on here that are important. But what is the post that like takes off and goes crazy? Yeah, the one with the big pile.
The one with the big pile of hot.
All right. So now that we've aired that, we are going to find out about fake news spreading to the judiciary, because you know what? I think everybody's a little frustrated on that front. And you have heard Lawrence Schaumburn before, because he's been with us in it's been a few months ago. Anyway, I had the date right there and then I lost it. So he has done all sorts of things, and the most recent thing that you have heard from him on our program regarding is the case. It was a California case, and I had such a nice little thing I was going to read for you, Lawrence. Ugh, forget it.
Oh, boy.
Oh, for God's sake. It was about class action lawsuit abuse. There, that's just the ugly way of doing it. Class action lawsuit abuse. And we all know because we've all done those class action things. You send it in, and then you get 45 cents back. And so he's been really dogging them on that, getting that straightened out. So I will link those shows, but that is not our topic today. So
our topic, though, is more serious even than the last one.
Imagine that. It seems like it just gets
The judiciary
deeper and deeper and deeper.
You know, basically giving credence to fake news and using that in their rulings is a frightening proposition, and I think that's where we're at today.
Hey,
well, if I can tell you about my case a little bit, it astounds me. It's I could say a funny thing happened to me on the way to the California Supreme Court. I was involved in a class action which had to do with whether or not the class would be notified that the lawyers were seeking $9 million in fees from the class's recovery and whether they'd be given the ability to object to it. And I had a lower court opinion which said, no, the class members didn't have to get notice. I took it to the California Court of Appeal, which is the second highest court in the state of California, and that's where this whole, for lack of a better term, fake news came up. Because what happened was the facts and law that I argued to the Court of Appeals had nothing to do with the opinion that they issued. And if I can be more specific, one of the issues in my case was whether the class members had notice. Both myself, class counsel, and the defendants agreed the class hadn't gotten notice. They said they weren't entitled to notice. I said they were. The Court of Appeal changed the facts to say that class members were aware of the fee. On the question of the law to be applied, the Court of Appeal cited a case which said class members need not have notice. That was what they put in the opinion. If you read the actual case they relied on, the case said class members don't have to receive notice, but then the very next sentence said, except in the following case, which was applied to my case. So the court just dropped off the except for part of the decision. Then I cited a United States Supreme Court case which said class members had to receive notice. This Court of Appeals said that the Supreme Court of the United States was in dispute on this issue because of another case, but the Supreme Court case that I relied on, that they cited, actually said there is no dispute on this issue.
Wow.
So to bring this all back home, you have the second highest court in the state, which you could say is antagonistic to the concept of the rule of law, that if the facts of the case they're presented with are not the facts that allow them to make the holding they want, they just change the facts. And if the law that is relevant to the issue is not the law they want, they either neglect to read parts of the opinion that they're relying on, or they claim a dispute which doesn't exist. It seems to me it's very close to living under tyranny. And not only what I've told you, you could understand maybe if one judge in a superior court someplace, but this was a three-judge panel of appellate lawyers out of a major city willing to have this opinion become precedent suggests to me that there is a level of imperial attitude that these judges have that's even more serious than, you know, Obamacare or problems with Trump, that these judges are establishing under the name of the rule of law a tyranny in which what they want becomes the rules regardless of the facts.
Well, Lawrence, why are they doing this? I mean, what is the benefit? Obviously, they're being influenced by somebody. I don't know if it's the lawyers or the lobby. Why are they ruling this way? And why are they not taking into account the actual facts in the case?
Well, I thought about this long and deeply, and I have to throw out sort of a multifaceted answer, okay? First of all, I think that they don't have a high authority. There's no higher authority that's going to wrap them or they're going to suffer any consequence if they make up the facts to a case or misuse the law. As long as the way they come out in the case is the way the prevailing culture wants them to come out, or even not even the prevailing culture, but maybe their own self-interest. In my case, you could say the fewer appeals by class members and class actions, the better. So if we come out with a ruling that restricts appeals, no one's going to really care. The court system is happier, fewer appeals. The plaintiff's lawyers, defendant's lawyers are happier, fewer appeals. And the only person's acts who's being gored are these unnamed class members. And one thing I thought about, you remember this famous quote by this woman who said, paying taxes is for the little people? You remember that quote?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't think of her name right now, but it seems to me that the way the judges look at it is that we're sort of the little people, and since whatever decision they make is the decision, how they get there is of less importance.
Sure.
So
it was Leona Helmsley.
Yes, exactly. Leona Helmsley.
So is this ruling, can it be appealed? I mean, can you take it like to the Supreme Court?
Well, I am before now the California Supreme Court, but I don't know. I mean, this is kind of like I feel that I've been privy to something that most people just don't know about. I'm just thinking now, for example, you know, they've just appointed this ex-FBI Director Mueller, and they describe him, at least in the article that I read, that he's the kind of guy who says, follow the facts, apply the applicable law, and don't be swayed by political or outside references. But I see that the opposite is really true, that these kind of statements, you know, he's a straight shooter, he goes by the facts, goes by the law, that's just for the consumption of the little people. And what's really going on is this, what's becoming more and more of a totalitarian system where getting the answer that the powers that be want is important, and you just say rules and facts and don't be swayed, but people who are in the system know that that's not true.
We need to take a break, Lawrence, but I want to stay on this vein when we come back, because I heard a story the other day that now Mueller is under fire because he was friends with Comey, so he needs to recuse himself. Everybody needs to recuse themselves.
I thought you were going to say he likes some kind of Russian food or something.
No, he does know a few Russian words.
Restaurant. He ate at a Russian restaurant. He's tainted.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
All right, we'll be back.
With our guest, Lawrence Schonbrunn. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
But good. about them.
A misunderstanding. So welcome back. We are here with Lawrence Schombrin. He is a nationally recognized authority on the issue of reasonableness of attorney's fees awarded in class actions. He's appeared on behalf of unnamed class members in approximately 200 class actions throughout the United States. He's a New York City native, now lives in Northern California. Huh, imagine that. Oh. I grew up in Connecticut, and I live in Northern California. Let's see, what are we going to call it? We're going to call it briskness, because rude sounds bad. We're going to come out here to the West, and we're going to speed these people up, aren't we, Lawrence?
Oh, yes.
Get them cracking. Okay, so this isn't just one judge that, you know, kind of, because we hear about those cases all the time, right? One judge makes a nutty ruling. This is actually really a lot worse, because he got everybody to go, you know, they all went together, I guess.
Yes, you've got an appellate court, the second highest court in the state, and you've got three judges. It can't be just an errant judge. It has to be some kind of formalized, understood process that the judiciary is involved and engaged in.
And so if they make crazy rulings, really, is there no recourse? I mean, if we get these judges that just kind of think they can cut their own path, you know, I mean...
It's horrible to say, but, you know, we're in a revolutionary situation in this country. I think you well know it. Conservatives really know it. And I don't think we have to look at what other... You look at Venezuela. You look at what other countries go through, and... It's sad to say, I don't want to think about it, but I don't see this situation righting itself. I just, the left has become more entrenched. They're painting Trump as a Hitler and the people who voted for him as racists. So I think this is a fight to the finish, unfortunately.
Kind of for what direction we go. Do we follow law and order, or... And it was interesting because I did see the headline that Tim Allen got booted off of whatever network he was on because he, you know, offended somebody. And we were watching that this morning. Bill had that clip up. That he offended the he, she, you know, on the fence people or whatever. All that stuff. And
well, he defended free speech. He defended
God,
the right to bear arms. I mean, and he didn't really offend it. He just basically said, this is what I believe.
Right.
And that was enough to boot him.
You're out.
It's not popular opinion.
So we're intolerant on TV, even with a comedian.
Well, that's not necessarily true either. It depends what side the jokes
true.
Are on.
I should preface that. And now if the court is following suit and not basing decisions. So what's your recourse as a guy that's tangled up in this? What is your recourse with this?
I can hope that the Supreme Court is going to comment on what the Court of Appeals did. But my sad experience is that, you remember, I appeared before the Supreme Court of California about a year ago, and they brushed all my arguments about these excessive attorney's fees under the rug, and they refused to deal with them. So I think a Supreme Court, I'm guessing, would do a less shabby job of writing the opinion. But in the last analysis, I think all these courts are in cahoots. They're in the same liberal wagon who view conservatives, you know, Hillary Clinton called us deplorables. Trump is a Hitler. We're all racists. And I think people, I can see how people of the left, with those kind of statements being made about us, don't feel that we're entitled to any respect or humanity, that we're evil and our opinions are evil, and anything you can do to combat evil is considered acceptable in modern liberalism.
Now, see, you, let's see, you got your law degree in 1969, so you've been at this a while. Have you seen this really take a turn, or has this been like, you know, the long slippery slope?
Well, I would say the long, I mean, let me just say, what the story I'm telling you now, even as I tell you, I can't believe it, at the Court of Appeals of the state of California level. And I believe if you sat down with a bunch of lawyers and told them this is the way a case was being handled, I think they wouldn't believe it. And that's why this is so startling. But has it been a slow drip and a slow process? I would say yes. There's, you know, the one problem is, you know, in a divorce case, in a car accident case, it doesn't necessarily cut across the entire judiciary. You could be involved with cases where these issues might not raise themselves. It's only in these issues that either involve social policy or involve powerful financial interests. And the class action is a case, it's an ideal for them. Powerful financial interests on one side, plaintiffs, defendants, the judiciary, all on one side, and the other side, you know, common people who have no power. So it's ideal for them to exercise this power, you know, against the overall interests of the people, using the rule of law, but undermining the rule of law in every sentence.
Do you think, I hear from people all the time that they think that these lifetime appointments and some of how we get our judges on the bench, you know, different courts, they get there different ways, but they said that, I've heard a lot of people say we need to look at how that's done because that could change it. What do you think about that?
Well, I would say it's kind of a Band-Aid, a palliative. The underlying problem is liberalism. That's the underlying
problem.
Oh,
no, we have to fix that first.
Okay, we have to end this interview at this point. It's, you've absolutely crossed the line here.
We
just don't speak that frankly.
Good job, Bill. That's funny. No, I mean, I we're totally with you. It's just that...
I mean, I don't want to be... You know, I was told not to be pessimistic. And I don't want to be pessimistic.
No, just be factual.
I could say I'm optimistic to the extent that I'm able to talk about this and that all of us conservatives know this on one degree or another. My point is that with this level of cynicism by the judiciary, I almost, you know, to me this equates to the fall of the Roman Empire. I mean, we're at sort of Roman Empire levels.
Well, you do. When the judiciary can write the rule, or actually, yeah, rewrite the rules and rewrite the laws at their own discretion, we seriously do have a problem because there really is no way to swiftly fix that problem. I mean, until these judges are... either retire or voted out, we're gonna continue to have to deal with this. Is there any other answer?
Well, I mean, I the worst part of this, I think these judges believe they're doing the right thing. That's the scary part.
Yeah, you're probably right there.
They don't see themselves as evil. They don't see themselves as perverting the law, undermining. They feel they would argue maybe, you know, in the last analysis, it's their opinion that matters, not how they reason it out, and that they're doing this for the good of the people, for the good of the system.
For the little guys. Yeah, that's pretty scary.
That's doubly hard to uproot.
Yeah, an ideological thing is always... I'd like to ask you, when we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you, when the judge issue comes onto the ballot, I'd love your opinion on how you research. Maybe we could give people some ideas. I know not all judges are there by the vote of the citizenry, but a lot of them are. And most people just literally, you know, check the box because they have no clue and don't know how to research it. So we'd like to hear from you on that. You are listening to We the People. We are here with Lawrence Schombrun. We spoke with him last May and last August, actually, on this topic. So we're sort of coming in late in the movie. If you'd like the background information, just go to the website and you can catch up. That, again, is wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back. The old county judge that held a grudge. We used to joke about that stuff.
Yeah.
Not anymore. So, these judges, Lawrence, that kind of, you know, we see them on our ballot. Nobody really knows how you become a circuit guy. If you're nobody knows how the judiciary really works. And if you do out there, I'm very sorry I offended you. Okay, most people don't know. What's the best way for them to research before they vote?
Well, I have difficulty also. I mean, typically, it's not like you can read the opinions of judges. You may, I'm thinking in Berkeley, California, there was this judge, I remember, with the shooting of the guy at the BART station. And this guy, Jacobson, as I remember his name, wrote a very intemperate opinion. And you sort of, if you remember that, then if this guy's name comes up again. But a typical judge, you're not going to know, you know, you can, but I think the best way is kind of who supports the judge. Don't in the ballots, I think they put the names of people who they want to put forward as supporting a particular judge. But in terms of reading opinions and seeing, you know, who's more willing to follow the law and follow the facts, and as opposed to being political and ideological, there is no simple way.
Yeah, I've found that before, and a lot of times, you know, vote for one and there's only one. So,
yes.
You know, it isn't.
Because people, I think, are people feel these issues are so remote to them and have such little power that people don't become involved in the issue of the judges. They just experience these sort of diktats from on high, and they either, you know, evade, avoid, or follow.
Sure.
That's sort of what your marching orders are, sad to say.
Well, and there's all this obsession with the legislature and the executive branch, whether you're at the federal or the state level. So that's really what's in the news, and that's what the left seizes on when, you know, when they want to make a big deal of something. Those two branches of government are kind of at the forefront, while the judiciary just churns away in the background. But there's some discussion about splitting up the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah, is that even possible?
What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, of course they could do it. I mean, Trump, sort of in one of his statements, I think, say he was interested in doing it, but these things happen so slowly, you know. There's so much between inertia and the control by the left of these institutions. I don't see that. I mean, I think one can't be sanguine about this situation. I mean, I know in Berkeley, if you've been reading about the free speech issue in Berkeley, and
you mean the lack
now,
of free speech? Yeah,
lack. Yes, I mean it reminds me, sad to say, of you. I'm just reading a book about Nazi Germany, about an ambassador who was telling the story that American citizens were regularly coming to the embassy complaining that they were being beaten up by Nazis if there was a flag, Nazi flag in the street, and they didn't, you know, raise their hand up with the Nazi salute. They were being beaten, just common citizens, and they were saying the police wouldn't become involved. And to me, there are shades of this in Berkeley right now, where the police allow these fascists with masks to attack Trump demonstrators, and they don't do anything about it. And, well, people do care, I would say, but still, the prevailing ethos is permitting it. So I think there's a long road down to ruin that we're on. And, I mean, I think these are the kind of forefront issues that give you an inkling as to what might happen.
Lawrence, I got a question for you. If, say this case were to go to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, get overturned, and these judges are now basically overruled. If a panel of judges is consistently overruled in the U.S. Supreme Court, is there any
happen?
Yeah, is there any consequence to that? I mean, do these judges have to answer to anybody?
No, because that's true of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Oh, yeah.
That supposedly is more routinely overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court than any other circuit in the country. But I believe, my belief, that they wear that as a badge of honor. That they are these leftists who have these left-leaning liberal ideas, and they're just more progressive than the than the conservative United States Supreme Court. So I think they don't see this as a problem. This is a badge of honor to them.
Yeah, I think you're right. Unfortunately, I think they do think that, but it all boils down to the electorate. If they see these judges being overturned time and time and time again, I guess our only recourse is to not vote for them when their term is up. Or is that a lifetime position? The Ninth Circuit?
No, I think those are lifetime positions. But you know, the thing is, the people of the country did something so incredible in this last election.
Oh, absolutely.
Where they rejected basically both political parties. They rejected the influence of Hollywood, rejected the influence of Wall Street, rejected the influence of the media, and put this guy Trump into power and gave a big long shot to Bernie Sanders. I mean, I don't know how much more short of open revolt that the citizens of the country could do to send the message.
Well, I think the next big message is the midterms. I think if that goes the same way, that would be a real statement on behalf of the electorate that they're just done with this liberal.
Yeah, it just keeps rolling a little farther.
Yeah, they're just tired of it.
Yeah, but I think our position, and I may be stepping on your toes. I don't know exactly how you feel, but
that's okay. You
I
can
think
for us.
That our position, we should have someone more worthy than President Trump to put forward these ideas. I understand why only someone like him could have succeeded, but I believe our positions and arguments deserve a worthier spokesperson than President Trump. And I think he's in deep problem right now.
Well, I think he is. I think he's in deep trouble right now too. However, I think it's going to take somebody like him to bring these issues to the forefront, and then it's going to be up to the people, up to the rest of the system to make the change that people are screaming for. Because if somebody at the top doesn't bring this up and bring it to the forefront and argue these points, we're going to continue down this.
Well, if we don't put some of this, like what you're seeing in Berkeley, if some of that doesn't get put back in the box, I mean, if that's allowed to continue,
that's not saying that people don't have the right to protest, but
not with masks on when they burn things down.
No, I don't believe you have the right to protest with a mask and a baseball bat. That's where you cross the line, and if there's no consequence or prosecution when you act that way, our rule of law is toast. I mean,
I think when that's the message that I'm trying to bring, I think we're there. It seems that we're there. I don't like to say it, but as much as I can say to the general public, this is my experience in this case, and there are so many factors of it that suggest that we're very far along the path to tyranny, a lot closer than we want to think.
Yeah, when the judiciary is, because that really is, where you hold the line, I guess. So we can't even count on them to actually use the rule of law. What were you thinking about the Supreme Court pick while we're kind of at it? Did you like that guy, Gorsuch?
He's better than what Hillary Clinton would have appointed.
Yeah, okay.
I really don't know enough about him to say, but certainly it's a better pick than Hillary Clinton, better than Kagan or Ruth Bader Ginsburg or that Sotomayor. I mean, it's a better appointment than them for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
But really save the republic? That's the question, and I don't know that he'll save the republic.
Now, what do you think? What do you think about was it Mueller, the FBI guy? I mean, he does have a long history.
What I would say about Mueller, do you remember what they said about Comey?
Yep.
If you remember, they said the exact same
things
about Comey that they're now saying about Mueller. Straight shooter, follows the law, will follow the facts where it leads them. So I don't think you can get that high up in politics. I think they're just saying this as pablum to the masses to make them believe that this guy is somehow going to be a neutral.
I don't know if he doesn't, find what they want him to find or make the decisions he wants, then he's going to be a bad guy, too. I mean, he'll have to go under the bus if he doesn't.
Well, he's already under fire because he was friends with Comey, supposedly. And I mean, I just don't see the two sides agreeing on anything right now.
We can't even agree to disagree.
No, we can't. And I guess that's just really, to me, a really dangerous place to be when you have such a divide in Washington, D.C., and until the voters make a clear cut choice one way or the other, and I think we really do need a two-party system. I think a three-party system's a loser, but a two-party system. But when they operate like this, nobody wins. Nobody wins, and I think that's where we are right now. We're like in gridlock right now.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Yeah, it's
and
a...
I think,
it's kind of like that old, remember, what was that old game, Red Rover? Yeah. Everybody holds arms and the other guys all rush him, and it just depends to see if the line breaks.
So where do you see the solution?
Well, I see that we have to take a break. Oh. So you quit asking Lawrence more questions all because right. We have to take a really quick break. you're luring him in
all
to
right.
answer
when we come
more
back,
questions.
We're going to talk about solutions.
Bill's got more questions for you, Lawrence.
We'll
be back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. I actually forgot that had anything to do about court. That's funny.
Back in the day.
All right, so we have Todd called in during the break, and he has a question for you, Lawrence.
Okay.
Hit it, Todd.
Yeah, good morning. Or afternoon.
afternoon.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just wondering if you would ask your guest. He'd made a comment earlier.
Todd, we need you to speak up, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that better?
Much. There you go.
Okay. Your guest made a comment earlier in the discussion that he thought Trump was in deep trouble. And I was just wondering if we could have him expand a little bit what his thought process that led him to that conclusion.
Nice. We can do that.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I'll take your answer in the air, okay?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, let's just say a preface. I think this trouble is of his own making. But this is what I see. I see, first of all, the fact that this a special prosecutor or whatever he is not limited to Russia and this Russia accusation, but as I understand it, it also includes sort of any other matter that this prosecutor deems worthy of investigating. And with a man that, let's say, has done as many things as Trump has done, I don't see them not being able to get him for something. Well, and then I must admit, I'm surprised that he would, if this is again true, that he asks the vice president and the attorney general to leave the room and tells the FBI director or asks him to sort of, if this is true, let's kind of put this Flynn investigation to rest. And then he says that he's happy with the special prosecutor, but let's get this over with quickly. I think all these things point, and the fact that I think the Republicans, with some justification, have just gotten tired of all the chaos that he's creating, these tweets, these stupid arguments, theories about the Civil War, and he just, the guy, a lot of these qualities that he exhibited during the campaign, he seems unable to control. So I just think they're going to get, this establishment, he hasn't been smart, and this establishment is going to get him.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree with what you're saying there. I think he has said a lot of things that...
Unforced errors, we call them.
Yeah, I think he should have maybe just not said them. But on the other hand, a lot of what is being reported, and I would almost venture to say the majority of what's being reported.
Back to the title of the show, right?
And just fake fixated news on is not true. And they throw stuff out. The other day I listened to a news broadcast that first said, well, we can't substantiate this statement. But how does that make you feel? And so then they have a big conversation on how something that possibly isn't even true, how does that make you feel? Who cares? Who cares how something like that makes me feel or anybody feel if it's not a substantiated fact?
We could probably benefit society greatly if we took the news and, you know, quote the news, and rolled it back to several hours per day. Instead of, 5,000 channels 24/7.
Yeah,
Because they got to do something to fill up the airtime.
They talk about things that are stories that have an anonymous source, and then they're just fixated on it. If they don't have the facts, I don't really believe they have any business reporting it. It's really muddying the waters, and it is making job very difficult.
Sure. There's a lot going on back there, despite all of this, that just isn't being reported.
Well, they don't report on that.
Right, which is fine, but there's still a lot going on that's good, that's actually getting done. So I guess while these guys, it's almost like, hey, look over here. I don't know. Maybe that's a good thing. It's hard to say.
Well, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. My response to you would be, yes, there's a lot of things that aren't true. Unfortunately, there are a lot of things that seem to be true that don't further the conservative message, that hurt the conservative message. And I would say to you, I mean, remember how Trump said how smart he was? I mean, this has been a given. The news is owned by the left.
Yep.
It's been a given for decades. I mean, rather than complain about it, you got to deal with it smartly.
Yeah.
And he hasn't dealt with it smartly.
No, he's dealt with it in his own way, I agree 100%, is not.
Well, the bad part is if you shoot from the hip, then almost anything attributed to you could be true. And that actually does not play in his favor. We are down to the last 20 seconds here, Lawrence, and it's been really nice catching up with you.
I agree. Feeling is mutual. It's always nice to speak with both of you, and I thank you very much for having me to try to get this message out what's going on in the courts.
Yeah, keep us posted on what happens with this, okay?
Okay.
Because we're not following the courts, obviously, and if there are things you think our listeners need to know, please get a hold of us, all right?
I certainly will.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.
That has been Lawrence Schonbrunn. And you can find all the information about him on our website, wethepeopleradio.us. We will be back to talk with Peter Cove and his book, Pour No More.
CNR Shasta Redding.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Oh, so much better, boys, than the first hour. Whoa. We were kind of discombobulated the first hour. That was very pro there.
Oh, we got our game on now.
lucky for our guest, Peter Cove, we're all warmed up. We're all organized now. So no more buffoonery. Well, I'm sure buffoonery will slip in later.
Far. Yeah.
We promise not to judge you.
Exactly. We talked about fake news in the judiciary on the first hour, so if you missed that, hit the archive at wethepeopleradio.us and you can catch up. So Peter Cove is a nationally acclaimed advocate for private solutions to the welfare dependency. And I think this would be a really hot topic right now everywhere, and we're so lucky to have him on here. He has written a new book called Pour No More, and you kind of have to be careful how you say it, otherwise it sounds like it's a different issue. But the subtitle here figures it out for you, Rethinking Dependency and the War on Poverty. He founded America Works, the first for-profit welfare-to-work company. He's created more than 1 million jobs for welfare recipients throughout through America Works and other private sector endeavors. For 50 years, he has been at the forefront of mitigating poverty by promoting jobs as a solution to welfare dependency. Imagine that. It can be done. He previously served in key posts in New York City municipal government, charitable foundations, and private companies. We are super excited because this is the thing that everybody says can't happen. So this hour will be all about
how it can happen.
How it can happen.
Now it has happened.
Peter, happy to have you on here.
Well, thank you, Aaron and Bill. I really appreciate being on.
Yeah, well, we have a ton to talk about.
Everybody says this can't take place. Well, you've been doing it for a long time. This, I guess, we should have called it the best kept secret, huh?
Well, I'm not sure it's a secret to some of the 1 million or more people that we've placed in jobs or the government that we've helped reduce public dependency. But maybe overall throughout the United States it is a secret. And there's probably a good reason for that, which we can get into a little later. And it has to do with the welfare industrial complex that we have in the United States that keeps good ideas and good programs from emerging and rising to the top.
So, is this a book that came over a long period of time? Obviously, you've been involved in this 50 years, or did you just say, you know what, this is crazy. People need to understand this idea.
Yeah, why'd you write this book?
Well, I sat down a few years ago to write the book about what had happened in our country since I started in the war on poverty in 1965. And what I saw was that in 1965, when Lyndon Johnson got the war on poverty started, the poverty rate in the United States was about 15.5%. And as I began writing the book a few years ago, the poverty rate was about 15.1%. But we had spent over 50 years, over $22 trillion, not billion, $22 trillion to solve the problem. And we hadn't moved the needle much. And I looked at it, it was kind of a mea culpa moment for me. I looked at this and I said, well, I was involved in this. And while I think some of the things I did may have worked, but my God, what we did didn't work overall. We spent over $22 trillion. And I said, I got to figure out what happened. Why was that? I mean, I had some clues, but I really had to dig in. And that brought me to the book's conclusion, which we can get to later on, in terms of how to solve poverty in the United States. But I really found myself exploring what had happened when I started being a foot soldier in the war on poverty, and then looking back and realizing in the war on poverty, poverty won. And that was very disheartening. And so I wrote the book to kind of expunge that part of my life, take a look at it, and then go forward.
Yeah, and I think that's your book, I think, is a topic that so many people have thought about, talked about, maybe had.
But you're a hater if you bring it up.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
you've had your own ideas on how to solve it, but you've just kept quiet about it because you know how it's going to go over. But how have you?
Well, I'd like to hear how it works.
Yeah, exactly.
A little bit more on how your program works, because obviously it does work.
Yeah, well, the proposal I have in the book isn't just for my program, but let me talk to you a little bit about the program, because it is significant, and it's been copied, and I'm glad of that. And there are many other organizations that are now doing what we do in New York and throughout the country. And we are, by the way, America Works is all over the country. We're in California as well. We place not just welfare recipients right now, but also ex-offenders, kids maxing out of the foster care system, veterans who are homeless. We really get to deal with people who normally would not have access to the labor market. And the way we do that, which I think was your question, is we act pretty much like an employment agency. Think of Manpower, Inc., or Kelly, or any of the ones you go to get a job. So you go there, and what do? Well, we do the same thing. We do more, though, we begin by finding out where the jobs are. We have salespeople that go out to companies and secure job openings. And then we take the people that we have, we match them to those jobs, send them out for interviews. And once hired, actually That's when our job really begins. Unlike regular employment agencies, we provide backup for the line management for the people, so that if there's anything that's getting in their way in the job, such as an abusive maid at home, or the daycare falls out, or a housing issue, or a transportation issue, or not understanding the mores of the workplace, we have staff that go out and work with the individual and the line manager, make sure the person succeeds. I say that the people have the static in their lives, many of them, not all of them, but many of them. And what we do is put a protective cocoon around them so that if they're a good worker, we help them to stay in the job.
Well,
it's really the model.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective, because if you look at what we've done, you know, this war on poverty, it's you know, get these people educated, get them trained. And how many people come out of college with a huge education and can't find a job? That, I think, you're right, is the wrong approach. I mean, granted, training and education is important, but jobs are important. Let's figure out how to put these people to work.
But most of the time you do find, and we see that with people that we all work with, the static in their lives. I think that's a good way to term it.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it really makes the difference between a person staying in the job and leaving. It really is less what they know. It's more that kind of issue. And yes, I have a lot in my book about the failure of education and training. No one's against education and training. It's where it fits and what you expect of it. And what we did in our country is we put it up front in terms of reducing welfare rolls, for instance. And instead of getting people quickly into jobs and then using the education and training to move them up in the job, we did it in reverse. And it didn't work. It was poor education for poor folk. I used to argue with Senator Monahan, who was a great senator, and analyzed the issue of dependency and growing dependency, particularly in the African-American community, on welfare and how it was breaking up the families. But his answer was education and training. I go into his office and I say, listen, we're running programs. You're an academic. He had a PhD. I'm not an academic. I said, but what I am is someone on the ground working with poor people, and I know what they need. And it's not to sit in another classroom where they've been failed by the education system.
So,
and he would disagree with me. He totally would disagree with me. Finally, I walked in one day, and his chief of staff said, well, Cove, you were right. I didn't even know what he was talking about. He said, well, there's some research, and the research now shows that education and training is not the first best way for a first strike in reducing welfare rolls. It's getting them a job.
Yep.
So what you're
saying...
Because
if they have some way to apply it, it's worth getting the education.
Right.
Otherwise, they're just...
So I think what you're saying is on-the-job training would be, in the long run, more valuable than spending years in college and work training programs and then going out looking for a job. Am I getting that?
Absolutely. I mean, the companies know what they need. They know
right.
specifically what they're going to need the next day. Now, is some training up front for some jobs appropriate? Of course it is. But generally speaking, it doesn't work very well for the people I'm dealing with. What works is getting them in there and then, as I said, using education and on-the-job training to move them up in the job. That really does work.
Sure, because then, you know, you've helped them with the hurdles, getting there on time, being dressed appropriately, having, you know, just, you know, your basic skill set match so that they can get a paycheck.
Right.
And then, you know, they feel like they're getting somewhere. People feel good about that.
But, you know, it makes a lot of sense to take that money and give it to employers to train people to do what they need, rather than give it to people for training so that they can go out and find a job in maybe a field where there is
no
need.
I don't know what the number is now, but let's face it, most people with a college degree don't do anything related to the field they studied.
Right.
Well, that's right.
I don't know.
No,
every time I've ever heard statistics on that, the numbers were huge.
Yeah, they're horrible.
They are horrible.
One of the things I suggest in the book is something that we've done at America Works. It's what you were talking about a couple of minutes ago. In the way we've done it, it's, you know, on-the-job training money from the federal government's been available for decades, but it's failed pretty much because It's been so bureaucratic, as you would expect from the federal government. And they just don't understand how the private sector works. What we did, we had money and from the government. And what we did is we went to companies and we said, tell you what, hire this person, put them on your payroll. They said, well, we don't have that money right now. Can you afford half the salary? So, okay, yeah. So, well, we'll pay you half the salary for 3 months, see how they do. Then the next 2 months, we'll pay you a quarter of the salary. Then after that, pick them up and put them on if they're working. And that worked because they got a chance to see the person. It deferred the cost for the company, and it worked tremendously well. We created so many jobs by doing that. The federal government, they'll say, well, we'll give you a tax credit. Well, a tax credit isn't very good for you if you're losing money. A tax credit, even if you're making money, you won't see that return for a year and a half anyway,
right,
from the government. So every month, we gave the company a check. They showed us the payroll register, and the person was there. We gave them a check for 50% of the wages for, as I said, 3 months, and then et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, it really you really can do it, and then they train the person.
That's a cool idea. We have a lot more to discuss with you, Mr. Cove. We need to take a really quick break, however, and we will be right back. Our guest today is Peter Cove. We're talking about Poor No More, Breaking the Cycle of Dependency, and the War on Poverty. So for all those of you that are sick of that, this is all about solutions. What a great hour. We'll be right back.
So many lies, you twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Dip, 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 dip. Get a job.
It's nice we get to have different music. Never had a get a job program. Obviously, that's what's wrong with our country. We've been doing this for years. Never did a get a job program. So I'm stealing right directly from your the things that your publicist sent us. But here's a one of the possible questions they gave us, and I just don't want to mess it up. It said, Poor No More contends that the only thing that successfully reduced poverty is work itself, which is the centerpiece of the bipartisan welfare reform bill in 1996. In the 90s, when the federal government embraced the work-first ideal, welfare rolls plummeted from 12.6 million to 4.7 million nationally within one decade. Why is work so critical to poverty alleviation? I mean, I don't know. That kind of answers itself. But do you support the Civilian Conservation Corps-style public work relief? And what do we do about the people who can't work? It's kind of like nine questions all in one. But
yeah,
but you've got the same list I do, I hope so.
Well, I do believe work is the solution. Unfortunately, particularly on the left in our country politically, work has become a four-letter word when
yes.
it comes to asking people who are dependent but are able-bodied to work. As an example, when President Obama was in office, his administration came to New York and told us that we could not continue to place people who were on food stamps and were able-bodied into jobs.
Why?
We had found... You have to ask the government why they do that. It's a pattern, though, I have to tell you, of trying to be nice, not forcing people to do things, not having reciprocal responsibility, which was the keystone of the 96 welfare reform bill that was passed, bipartisan bill, Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, and it said, if you're on welfare and you're able-bodied and there is a job, then you have to work. You have to go to work. and daycare will be provided, but you've got to go to work. And it's been eroding in this country. Obama eroded a lot of it through directives to states. He eroded it with food stamp recipients who were not then told they should go to work, even though that is part of the law. Work is the answer. And yet we find that people think we're being cruel to ask people who are receiving from government assistance to go to work. I'm going to tell you something. I've been in this business over 50 years, and I know I don't look it. You can tell me that. But the truth is that people who I deal with, poor people, do want to work. They want that self-aggrandizement. They want to be able to show their children what they can do. And our government gets in the way. It puts all kinds of obstacles and doesn't put the kind of incentives that we need. It is really not that there are a lot of bums in this country. And sure, there's some bums. I have some friends that are bums. But most people really want to work. But the government gets in the way.
And so what's in it for the, I mean, is it just that the government has programs and people who run the programs and they keep getting bigger and they can have more programs and they can do housing and this and that and the other? And it seems like it's all about the infrastructure of bureaucracy rather than successfully completing the mission.
Well, that's absolutely true. There's a joke in my industry. If it doesn't work, double the funding. I mean, it's basically that. But
yes.
Let me give you an anecdote to begin to give you a sense of what the welfare industrial complex is, what I call it in this country, and why it keeps bad programs going and doesn't let good ones in. There was a woman who was in the state assembly in New York State. She headed the welfare committee. She came to visit my company, America Works, and see our welfare to work program. We took her around. She saw it. I said, what do you think? She says, I think it's the best welfare-to-work program I've ever seen. I said, are you going to support it? She said, no. I said, why? She said, well, there's a small little program down the street from my campaign office. They're not as big as yours, Peter. They run a welfare-to-work program. Not as big. It's not as good. But on election day, they bring out the votes.
Wow.
That's what goes on. And here was a woman who, very liberal Democrat, went in for all the good reasons to help people, but had no qualms about selling out poor people to keep a job.
Wow.
You know, it's kind of what we think is going on, but nice of you to be able to report that.
I wish it wasn't.
Well, no kidding.
But that is what goes on. And you have all of these programs that support politicians and continue to get funding. Now, this isn't everywhere all the time. And, in fact, I'll tell you something that America Works has done to try to change that game. And we have in New York City and in some other cities as well. But it does go on. And what we've done is we've had government start to pay for performance so that we only get paid. And other organizations like us in New York and some other cities, only if we get the person off welfare and only if they stay in that job for 3 to 6 months.
Oh.
And that changes the game, because either you stay in business and keep the program going because you're successful, or you go out of business because you haven't been able to place the people and you don't get any money. So that really does change the game. But I'm going to tell you, it's very hard. Politicians really don't like it and don't want it.
Wow. Are you, okay, so, like here in our area, and I know this is true in a lot of places, but California's made some very bad decisions. One of the assembly bills it was supposed to be for prison overcrowding, so they pushed a whole bunch of criminals out onto the street. Then it was supposed to be safer schools and safer neighborhoods or some, you know, initiative that went through that the voters voted for, that turned a bunch of felonies into misdemeanors. So this was all targeted in large part at drug crimes. So now we have all the drug users living on the street. You know, heroin is, you know, epidemic levels and all that. And I know there are lots of other cities that are dealing with this. But what are you doing with those folks? Like, is your
I'll tell you, we have a program in San Francisco, a company in San Francisco, dealing with ex-offenders. And we have programs all over the country dealing with ex-offenders, people who are coming out And what we do is very quickly get them into work, which keeps them off the street, which begins to socialize them, re-socialize them into the communities. And it's been phenomenally successful. There have been, one of the things AmericaWorks does is we always have research projects on our programs. We want to be sure that even though we think they're doing, we're doing good, that they really are doing well. And the research that's been done, I won't go into it right now, but there's outside research, including a controlled experimental study, which is the gold standard, which showed that when we got people jobs coming out of jail, we reduced the recidivism rate significantly. And that has been a really big deal for us, because what we've been able to show is that if you so to speak, capture people
for
as
sure.
soon as they're coming out of jail and move them very quickly into jobs, you do reduce the rate. Let me give you the most stark example. We had a program in North Carolina, and the program had people who were on the streets, had violent felon convictions, had been in jail. The police identified these people as the most likely to reoffend. Those were the ones that were referred to us. And after a year's period of time, their recidivism rate was about 7%, and the statewide rate was about 35%. And the statewide rate, of course, included a much easier group, all told. So you see what the difference can be when you have programs moving people quickly into jobs who are coming out of jail.
Let me ask you this. I know a lot of feedback I get on this is you've got so many people that have been on public assistance for so long, they are comfortable on it, and they don't necessarily want to work. One of the things that I think you mentioned in your book was that every able-bodied person that can work should work. What do you do with these folks that are perfectly satisfied living on government assistance?
Or who are multi-generational.
And don't want to work but want to be on government assistance. What do you do with those folks?
First of all, that I disagree with the basic premise.
Uh-huh. It's a stereotype.
That there are a large group of people out there that don't want to work and can't work and are comfortable. You can't be comfortable on welfare. There's no comfort in it. I mean, you can subsist, but you're not going to be very comfortable. What we do is we have them visualize and see what the opportunity is, rather than sitting home and collecting a paycheck. And frankly, the welfare law of 96 says you have to go to work. You just can't stay home. And that about 8 months ago, the House. I'm sorry, I'm blocking his name, but Speaker of the House Paul Ryan
uh-huh.
came to our office in Milwaukee, and he told me that when they take up welfare this coming year, they are going to put work requirements into many of the public programs that keep people home, including disability. And I'll talk a little bit about disability if you want, because we have a large program going on right now, moving people who are disabled into jobs.
Absolutely. Let's take a really quick break and come back and do that. I don't want to cut you off partway, but that's a biggie, because we do have a lot of people who they might not be able to do what they used to do, but sounds like you have found a way around it.
Yeah, it's the largest growing welfare population in our country.
Well, we're seeing that locally, so I guess those statistics have to start somewhere.
Good.
Unfortunately, we're helping to make them. So we're going to come right back with our guest, Peter Cove. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Hey! just an unruly mob, and I should get a haircut and get a real job. Get a haircut and get a real job. Clean your act up and don't be a slob. Get it together like your big brother Bob. Why don't you get a haircut and get a real job?
There you go.
Yeah, we knew that was coming.
Is that like the America Works theme song there, Peter?
No, I think get a job is.
Yeah, we don't have to have a real job. Just out of curiosity, before we do the other part,
fake jobs.
What kind of work? I mean, do people just wind up doing a little bit of everything? Is there an industry that lends itself well to this?
Yeah, it kind of is a little bit of everything. It really depends on the skills that people bring. And remember, since we're taking ex-offenders, but we're also taking veterans, who might have some experience. There are a lot. But let me just give you examples. We place people who are security personnel, home health aides, customer service agents, drivers, food service workers, medical billing, retail associates, office work, IT work, construction. This might interest some people. Someone would say to me, "Well, what do you do with somebody who's coming out of jail and they've got, an eighth grade or ninth grade education, and what are you going to do with them?" And I say, "I'll tell you what we do with them. We put them in the back offices of places and they're customer service agents on the phone." Some of them, they've been out in the street selling stuff. They've been out doing things. Some of them are terrific at BS, and they're great on the phone. And we put them in a back room. They're not going to harm anybody, and they have a great job. So you have to look at what the skill sets are of the people. But there are, as I mentioned, a whole bunch of different things that we place people in. I only gave you a smattering.
Sure. So do you find there's any difference or more difficulty or less difficulty with people who are kind of fresh down on their luck, or people who were maybe raised in a household where perhaps their entire life they lived on public assistance?
If you've been in a lifestyle that has been to be publicly dependent,
that's all you know.
It is harder, but it's not hard. I say it's harder, but not hard. We really are able. You know what happens? You get a person in, and they say, "Well, I can't go. I don't have daycare, and anyway, no one wants me, and I'd rather stay home." Let me tell you what's going on there. What's going on there is insecurity about anybody seeing them for anything.
Right.
So we send them out on a job interview, and the company says, "Okay, she can show up next Monday." And all of a sudden, she finds daycare, or she wants the job. She decides that it's a good idea that she now move on and become a productive member of society. What was going on was a lot of insecurity about who she was and who would ever want her. And him, too. And I'm just thinking the welfare mothers are right for a second. It's a matter of helping them to visualize what a life could be that would be different. Change is hard. The only person that likes change is a wet baby. And it's hard. You have to work with people on this.
You know, one of the things, I don't know, I kind of relate to this a little bit. I had a previous position with a company where I had to hire some help, and we had a position open that was starting at $15 an hour. We were going to train them, and it took me over 2 years to fill that position because people didn't want to come in and start at $15 an hour because they made more money than that on public assistance. They got free medical. So the benefits, when they weighed all the benefits they got for nothing versus a $15 an hour job, they wouldn't take it. And I know that is kind of contrary to what you're saying, but that was
okay. How can you?
That's the facts.
How could you have helped Bill?
Yeah, how would I have gotten over? How do you get over that hump?
Yeah, first of all, when someone goes to take a job, they don't lose all the benefits. For instance, at a $15 an hour job, they still be getting food stamps. For instance, they still be getting housing assistance. For instance, I mean, I can go on and on.
Sure.
The truth is, once you take a job, doesn't mean you everything drops out and you get nothing. In fact, you do better. And what we have are people who work at the, you know, at the intake level, talking with people and showing them exactly what that wage will do for them and what the additional benefits that they're now receiving they can continue to receive while they are working. So it doesn't work like, you know, you go out, you get a job and everything drops out. And by the way, that's one of the things that is really wonderful about a program that we're running for people who are disabled. There's a federal program called Ticket to Work. And we actually have one going in California as well, where we're taking people who are on disability, SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance, and moving them into jobs. This is all voluntary. They're not forced. But voluntarily, they go into jobs. And what the fear would be of anybody on disability would be they'd lose that payment.
Sure.
And what
yes.
if the company, what if the company fired them or they had to lay people off or whatever? And what we're able to do is we're able to wean them a bit. They don't go cold turkey. They are able to keep the benefit for quite a bit of time until things are stabilized and they are really working well. And they can go back on later on if they do get terminated for any reason.
Right.
Interesting.
So that, by doing that, though, doesn't that kind of tell the disability folks that you're not really disabled, that you can work? And so then when you go to reapply, they say, well, heck, you worked for the last 8 months and you were able to do the job. Why are you filing for disability now?
They waive that.
They do.
They can go back on. That's a very good point, but they're not held accountable for that.
Oh, well, that's...
Logically, in a way, they shouldn't be, but they're not.
Yeah.
Right, but I mean, actually holding them accountable, although I would normally agree with that, that actually hurts their ability to go out and replace the Social Security income. I mean, it keeps them afraid and not willing to try. So, actually, I think that's a great idea.
It really works. It's really working. And I'll tell you something. We estimate that, very conservatively, 30% of people who are on disability, federal disability, can work. And you know what that would save? That would save $50 to $60 billion a year in our country if they went to work.
Absolutely. Well, we constantly, you know, we're always disincentivizing the work. You know, you have to live on this small fixed amount because if you work, you're going to get penalized. So,
right.
I mean, I think
that's absolutely right.
I think the programs are all set up, screwed up to start with. But okay, so one of the things that I can't believe it—we've only got 15 minutes left. What the heck? So one of the questions that was listed here, and it's the same one I have, is what are the biggest barriers to getting welfare recipients into your program? Like, how do they find you, or how do you find them?
There aren't a lot of barriers of getting them into the program. First of all, if they're on welfare, they are referred by their case manager to come to our company to be placed in jobs. So we get referrals from the welfare departments around the country.
Mm.
If they're a veteran, we have people who work with the veterans associations, and we are known to be able to place people who are veterans into jobs, et cetera. And the same with ex-offenders. It's not hard getting people in. It's getting the jobs and keeping the people in the jobs. And that really, the latter part is the hardest. The hardest is keeping the person in the job. As we talked earlier about that static that goes on.
Right.
That's the real issue. And my wife, Lee Bose, who's the CEO of our company, once we get a person into a job, that's when our job begins. And that's true. We really, getting a person into the job isn't that hard. It's keeping them there that really is the big issue.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me this, how many people actually work in your company, you know, to manage
all
of this?
Nationwide, we have around 400 people working in our company.
Okay, that's not very many. I was thinking it would take a lot more people to keep track of, you know, I mean, when you're going to put this many people to work, I guess once they get going, is it a little bit, you know, like airplanes?
That's right.
If the runway's long enough
exactly.
And there's enough lift, they...
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. The number of people that are having problems at any one time you know, might be a third or less of the people we place. So it's they just keep moving along, and we don't need that many people. But 400 people is a lot of people.
Yeah, it's still a lot of people. Tell me this: you were. It says here that you were a real believer in all the, you know, liberal policies, social services, and all that kind of stuff. But then, obviously, you changed your mind. What was the catalyst for that?
Well, the catalyst was running programs and seeing how they worked and realizing, as I said when I talked to Senator Monahan, that the programs that he wanted didn't work on the ground. They sounded good, but they just didn't work. And so it was an accumulation over the decades of experience. I'm not an academic. That isn't who I am. I'm a person who's run programs, designed programs, evaluated programs. I saw what was real. I saw what worked. And as we moved along, I realized that the programs that we were establishing in 1965 to help people become independent and self-sufficient were just plain not working. And so I started to kind of redesign programs. And the program America Works, I started in 1984 as the first for-profit welfare to work company, because I had experienced some programs that I ran in the not-for-profit sector, and I saw that they were working, that they were getting people jobs, that they were helping companies get good employees and reducing public expenditures. So I decided I wanted to take it on the road, and I set up a private for-profit company to do that. And it really came out of experience. But I'll tell you something. Saul Bellow has a great quote. He said, a great deal of intelligence can be invested in ignorance when the need for illusion is deep. And that really was what was happening. The people in my field were stuck on stupid. They just didn't want to leave what they believed should work, even though it didn't work. And they just kept doing it and kept doing it.
Yeah, you know, and now we look at what's been the new thing has been, you know, all secondary education needs to be free, because if it was all free, then these people would all be able to go to work and all that.
Hey, we need to take a break, but when we come back, yeah, let's talk about what do you think the chances of real reform in...
So you don't like my question?
Well, no, no, I like your question.
I haven't been able to give you a bad time at all.
Yeah, no,
2 hours have been really nice. Like,
and I'll discuss my solution as well.
There you go.
You'll have the whole thing when we come back. All right, we're going to bicker off stage here. You're listening to We the People. Our guest is Peter Cove, author of Poor No More. We'll be right back. You can find everything about our guest and our program and any contact information you'd like for us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Yeah, I liked your question. I thought my question was better. No, I trumped your question.
We'll discuss this off the air.
The hunger's for your love, and I'm waiting in your welfare line. Well, I ain't got nothing but
the... What the heck is that?
That's a Buck Owens classic.
Nice.
Waiting in your welfare line.
I like it. All right, take it away, Peter.
Speaking of the hungries.
Speaking of the hungries.
You're going to give us an update?
All right, let us hear all about the solutions.
Absolutely. As I thought about how I would create a way in which to reduce dependency in this country, because it really is dependency that we're talking about, I decided that the way to do it is to get rid of all welfare, except for people who physically or mentally cannot go to work. That we should get rid of all poverty programs, because, as we indicated earlier in the show, we spent over $22 trillion and it hasn't worked.
Right.
And take all that money, and it's a lot of money, and create jobs in the private sector And when there isn't enough, and when we don't have enough there, create them in the public sector. And say to a woman who's had a child and comes to government for money, no, but you can have a job in daycare. And isn't that what we all want? Isn't that what people do want? They want to work. Isn't that what society wants? Rather than taking money, which is being spent now, and sending it to people to sit home, I'm suggesting let's take that money and create the jobs so they can work. To me, that's such a better solution for our country.
Sure, and it is. I don't think anybody would. Well, okay, there would be. I think most people would agree with that. Most people just don't think that it'll work. But you guys, of course, have proven that obviously it does work.
Yeah, I think it would work, and I think politicians, and I suggest this in the book, politicians would be interested in this because instead of handing out contracts for programs that don't work, they'd be handing out jobs for people to go to in states all around the country. We used to have a situation where we had patronage in this country, where that is what politicians did. They handed out jobs to their people who voted for them and others, and it worked. I'd like to see us doing that for everybody who's poor and unemployed, the politicians creating those jobs with the exact same money. My proposal is budget neutral. It doesn't cost any more money to do what I'm suggesting. In fact, it costs less, and you get people out there working instead of staying home and collecting a paycheck. And as I indicated earlier to both of you, people would rather work than not work.
So you're not implying that the federal government create businesses. You're saying give that money to existing businesses to expand and employ more people.
Exactly. The way I suggested the wage supplementation, which we talked about earlier, in terms of getting money to companies to offset the cost of wages for a period of time. And then, as I said, if there aren't enough jobs in the private sector, then we would have the opportunity to establish WPA and other public programs for people to go to work. But, you know, there's probably going to be a large infrastructure program in this country, and that's going to open up a lot of jobs for the kind of people I place.
Sure, provided that we actually do that. Why, and is it just an ideological thing that keeps people locked in the rut of, you know, it's not fair to ask them to work or whatever silliness they say?
I mean, yes, it is ideological. And on that one, I'm very critical of people who are on the left and many people in the Democratic Party who would prefer to see people getting handouts and seeing them getting the help to move them up in work. It is ideological, and it is unfair. And it is the people who want to be kinder and gentler instead of really helping people to get what they really do want.
But you look at the...
It is ideological.
Yeah, because you look at the places where the long-term welfare and, you know, quote, poverty programs have. We were just watching a program last night, and it was literally they were driving through Detroit, just filming Detroit. What? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible.
What
well,
do you like, say?
And it gets back to, like, the whole Obamaphone thing. I mean, how many times have you seen people on the sidewalk are holding a sign and they're talking on their cell phone? I don't get that. How does that help somebody who's either on public assistance or living in a shelter? I would think a cell phone would be the last thing they would need to improve their life. I mean, they need a job.
That's exactly right. And what I'm suggesting is we get rid of all of that stuff and we use the money to get people working. And then they can afford all of the things that are being given now.
Mm-hmm.
How much?
Like food stamps.
Have you done, I'm sure you have, done the math for maybe not the whole country, but for a state? And if you converted their welfare budget or a city, how does that come out?
I actually haven't done that, but I've just been asked by the governor of Missouri to come out and take a look at their welfare program, and they would like to revamp it. And it's going to give me the opportunity to see whether that could be applied on a statewide level and what they're spending their money on now.
Nice. Would you do us a favor? And if you do wind up crunching the numbers on that, would you send them to us? We'd love to post those.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, everybody doesn't always have time Sunday afternoon, but we post this commercial-free archive with all your information and the link to your book, by the way.
Great.
Because that, of course, would be the entire point here. If people really want to get the full story, you could find the book, Poor No More, Rethinking Dependency and the War on Poverty, by Peter Cove, C-O-V-E. Nice and simple there. And
they can get that on Amazon.com. They can get it on in the local bookstore and order it. And also they should go to our website, AmericaWorks.com, and take a look at what we do and how we do it and where we are.
Right. I was spying on some of that and really interesting. And so, you know, for those folks that are driving or something, that's all linked up on our site there. And I hope people do investigate this because, honestly, we have people all over the country that listen. You're all represented by somebody who thinks that giving welfare recipients more money is going to solve their problems. I would hope you'd reach out to your elected official and ask them to read Peter's book or
take a hard look at
make
it.
That big investment and buy the book and give it to them.
Hey, thanks for coming on, Peter.
I just want to suggest that the book is a fun read because it's more of a personal book. It's not just all policy. It's a memoir.
Nice.
Outstanding.
Well, we're really looking forward to it. We hope you stay in touch with us as this develops because I could see that we could talk about this a lot, especially if there's something happening at the federal level with legislation and you'd like to promote a take on it, please get a hold of us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks right, a million. Thanks. Have a great day.
I will, and I'll keep my dog out of the room.
No problem. All right, you've been listening to We the People. Please join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Send this show to your friends and family and get them all smartened up. We'll see you next week.
KC&R, Shasta Redding.